Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 43. Thank you very much for tuning in. We've got John Ronson this week and it's a two-parter again, which is wonderfully exciting. I should mention just quickly the overwhelming response to both of last week's podcasts. In fact, obviously expected a huge reaction to Amanda Palmer. She's got a huge following and is a wonderful, entertaining, interesting lady. But the reaction to the Refugee Week special, in which I spoke to a lady called Ramel, who is a refugee from the Democratic Republic of Congo, and she basically told her story, and the reaction to that has been absolutely overwhelming. So thank you very much to everyone who supported that, who shared kind words, and who is supporting the Red Cross campaign that was kind of intertwined with. Thank you very much for tuning in. This week, we've got John Ronson. Before that, I should mention, obviously, a good way to support the podcast is to go to speechdevelopmentrecords.com. Check us out. You may have already heard, the way we do our adverts is they kind of get dropped in depending on when you download it. So you may have already heard the secret word and secret code to get the exclusive Distraction Pieces podcast t-shirts. It's pretty exciting, right? No? Okay. Basically, we've got a limited t-shirt. If you go to team3w.distractionpiecespodcast.com, and you'll be able to find that hidden bit of merch. We're not going to be talking about it online. I'm talking too much already. Support the podcast, support the website, support the label. Thank you. Let's get on to John Ronson. What an amazing dude. Are we met up to chat? As you'll hear him, he invited me. He had one spare day and it was on a Sunday. And the night before, I don't think you can tell, but I'd been up till 6:30 watching a UFC 188. Because I stay up for all the UFC events because I'm obsessed. And then I had to leave my house at 9 to go and interview John. So I'm impressed with how awake and with it I was. I knocked back some alpha brain, which I think helped. And it was amazing. It was so relaxing and so nice. He's an amazing talker. He's got amazing stories. It was another one that we had to turn into a two-parter because he just had so much interesting stuff to say that I didn't want to kind of cut things off and say, oh, we're kind of over 90 minutes. Let's wrap it up. So when we got to around the hour mark, I said, yeah, let's pause and continue in the second half. And once again, I mean, I can't decide which one's my favourite half, so hopefully you'll listen to them both. This one, as usual, appeared at midnight, so it's on your phone for you to enjoy on your way to work and so on and so forth. The second part, part two, will be out the same day today, Wednesday, at midday. So midnight and midday. So hopefully, if you enjoyed this one or are enjoying this one on your way into work on Wednesday morning, you can grab the other one while you're at work and have that for the way home. Or you can listen to it tomorrow on the way to work. It's up to you when you choose to listen to this podcast. And because it's up to you, I'm very aware that you're probably all thinking, stop talking now, please, Pip. So since you're thinking that, I'm now going to stop. I'll be back at the end. But for now, enjoy Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 43 with John Ronson. Part one.
This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces.
Right, I'm joined by John Ronson.
Hiya.
Thank you for having me in your nice hotel room.
Yeah, it's all right. It's not quite as fancy as it looks on the website.
Yeah, you were kind of nervous and excited about how fancy it was going to be.
Yeah.
I still did get quite quizzed as I came in, so it's fancy enough.
It's the fancy lobby, shitty room.
Yeah, it's all right.
It's all right.
I feel bad because I've got here and we've kind of... Yeah. I feel as if we've kicked your son Joel out immediately. He's gone to have a look around London and have a bit of a... Yeah. And get a wake-up. But I do feel as soon as we're up, like, if you could just, you know... So I'm hoping he'll arrive back at some point throughout and we can... That'll be fine.
I hope so. It's good. He's been out of London for about 8-10 months, so it's kind of weird.
That's crazy, isn't it? That's a long time. Is that the longest he's had?
No, I think the first... we left New York, like we moved to New York 3 years ago, and I think I was back all the time. Like I'm back like about once a month.
Yeah.
But I think Joel was away for like a year. It was weird. It was weird because, like, you know, it's sometimes you think, well, where do I live? Who am I? Now?
Yeah, completely.
And I think we're probably all still thinking that.
I was going to say, do you feel any more settled in now? I'd imagine Joel feels more settled in than you then, if you're back so regularly.
Yeah. Feel a bit more settled. I had a rough first year. I lost all my confidence. It's funny, you know. Yeah, you know, you can build up, you know, over like 30 years of like confidence and then just, you know, something goes out of kilter and it just all goes.
Yeah.
And for the first year, it all went. And what sort of rescued me was this promoter in New York called Marianne Ways kind of contacted me and said, do you want to do a show every month with Maeve Higgins? And because Maeve had just moved over to New York. And that just, just doing that made me feel better.
Yeah.
And now I think I really like it.
I think it's really important at times to get those opportunities or make those opportunities to reassure you that you're where you are for reason and for ability and skill. I always remember I had a relationship end out of the blue a while ago, and I was feeling really kind of, my head was shaken by it. And I got back and I heard a song, as someone had lent me a CD, and I heard a song and I liked it, and I wrote a vocal over the top of this song, and I recorded it and made a video and released it all within a week. It was like, it wasn't illegal. It was a bootleg type thing, but just that process of doing something that I was really proud of in 1 week and then doing a video that people were excited about made me go, right, no, actually, I know who I am. I know I've got this. I know what my abilities are. I know there's a reason I'm here. So I think things like that can be important to be thrown into those kind of things to go, all right, yeah, this isn't just a weird coincidence. Because it can feel like you're stumbling along a lot of times, I find.
Yeah, and sometimes I think maybe you should do things because they're hard. I mean, that was one of the reasons why we moved to New York. It's like, you know, why not do it? Because it's hard.
Yeah.
And actually, I mean, one thing that came out of me moving to New York was writing my book on public shaming.
Yeah.
Because I think it was, I don't put any of this in a book, but I think it was the experience of feeling sort of lost.
Yeah. Yeah.
That made me empathise with the people being shamed.
Yeah.
You know, because if you're feeling a bit sort of broken, you're going to empathise with people being broken.
Yeah, yeah,
so,
yeah.
So that
of
came
course.
Out of it.
Yeah. So again, that allows you to have that, or the more you research it, the more you'll relate to it as well, I'd imagine.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
It's weird. On these interviews, I often start with a bit of growing up, of this and this and that. There's so much I want to talk to you about on your books that I'm kind of, if we get round to that at the end, then we'll get round to it, but I'd rather get into the, and let's start with your most recent books, So You've Been Publicly Shamed. What was the motivation behind that? And
Well, I think it was moving to New York and just feeling, I remember feeling like, actually it started off, I felt like I haven't said, none of this is in the book, and I haven't really said any of this before. I sort of felt like I was, like, you know, lost and failing in New York, and I wanted to do something that sort of reflected that.
Yeah.
And what I started doing, actually, was stuff on Stop and Frisk. I started going up to the Bronx and hanging out with this defence group called the Bronx Defenders.
Right.
And hanging out with people whose lives were being, like, you know, destroyed through Stop and Frisk.
Yeah.
And then just how fucked up the judicial process is how... And so these were the thoughts that were sort of swirling around. I was also really interested in, like, memory loss. Like, my father's completely lost his memory.
It's really?
Yeah, it's all gone. And sometimes I worry that's starting to happen to me.
Yeah.
My wife, as a special treat for me, booked me into a spa for the weekend, which I think's like the worst special treat for me because I don't like being touched. I don't like pampering. But anyway, I was being massaged.
It feels like it wasn't a passive aggressive treat in any way, was it? You hadn't done something to piss off. She's like, right, here's a. You have a nice weekend away.
Yeah,
you have a nice
Channings or something. Yeah. It's like everything I hate. but as I was being massaged, I was talking about my really bad memory. And I said, I can't remember anything about my childhood much. And she said, well, most people who don't remember anything about their childhood, when they recover their lost memories, it turns out that they were sexually abused by their parents. So I went, well, I'd remember that.
Yeah.
Anyway, that got me thinking that got me thinking about loss of memory. And then that got me thinking about how, like when witnesses... this is really roundabout, I apologise.
No, it's fine.
Okay. But that got me thinking about how when witnesses in courts... you know, how can their memory be trusted? And
yeah, I mean, it's been proven numerous times how much the brain fills in blanks and makes stuff up and makes us... We will, for example, we'll have solid memories in our head, but the reason we have them is because we've been told that story happened and things like that. So they're kind of false memories and but you're not a liar because of that. They're things that you've built now, but that's how powerful the brain is.
Yeah, absolutely. And then there's been lots of research on, like... when you're looking at kind of mugshots, like if a victim is looking at mugshots, is it better for the brain to show them it sequentially or simultaneously? Mm-hmm. And actually, my memory's shit, I can't remember which is better.
The answer is brilliant, perfect.
But I was doing all of this research, but none of it was coming... For some reason, none of it was coming alive for me.
Right.
It's like I really wanted to do something on the justice system, and...
It's fascinating in America in particular, isn't it? I was watching recently on John Oliver's show, he was doing a thing about the bail system in America and how crazy it is that there's so many people in prison because they can't afford not to be, and it's on silly things. And there's certain states that have brought in a bail system that they can only issue a financial bail if the person can afford it, which seems ludicrous, but actually makes perfect sense, because the point of bail isn't to say... Or it shouldn't be, if you're too poor, you're in prison, which is what it's become a lot in America. It's become, we're imprisoning people on traffic charges and stuff like that because they can't afford a grand to get, and they're spending some time in prison. It's hideous.
America's the most incarcerated country, you know, in the world.
Yeah.
The most incarceration-friendly country in the world. And in fact, the other day I was interviewing, well, a few months ago now, I was interviewing this... outsider artist called Mingering Mike, who had created this fake soul career and just drew all the records.
Yeah.
This is
amazing.
A great story, actually. I know this is a real kind of tangent, but okay, so basically, it all starts with this guy called Dory, who was this big soul funk fan, and he was like a crate digger. He'd go to like flea markets and look through the crates.
Yeah.
And one day he was doing all of this, and he found 38. records by a soul singer he had never heard of called Mingering Mike, and it was things like, you know, his first album was called Sitting by the Window, and it was a picture of Mike sitting out the window, and then there was like tribute, like he did a Bruce Lee concept album.
Brilliant.
And there was like live albums, and like Dory was going, you know, I thought I knew everything about the soul funk world,
and then
like,
I found this guy
and it turned out, and so we tracked him down, and it turned out that he was this painfully shy guy, like living in a inner city community in Washington DC, and he just created all of this, you know, this fake soul superstar.
I love it.
Yeah, and he even like cut out the records and sprayed them to make them look like proper vinyl. They were just cardboard.
Amazing! That's genius.
And he would like write all these like song titles on the back of the album, and the grooves in the fake records matched like the number of songs on the back. And it was all like
amazing, the intricacy.
So I met him. I did a story on Mingering Mike, and I met him in DC.
Yeah.
And the reason why I mention it is because he was a draft dodger.
Right.
He was just too scared. Like, he was being sent to Vietnam, and he was just scared.
Yeah.
And so he became a draft dodger. And, if he'd been caught, it would have been either a $10,000 fine or 5 years in prison. So what does that mean for him? It means five years in prison.
Yeah, that's no doubt. That's clearly what's going ahead. So, I mean, you do a lot of your work as an author and as a journalist and all these kind of things is really a looking into... I don't know, not really taboo, unusual, but quite human things. So do you find that is a hard thing to do? Because as you were saying, if you're looking into loss of memory, then you're going to be flagging a lot of stuff that you might not have flagged. Like, oh, actually, I don't remember a lot of this, and I don't remember a lot of that. I found it when I was reading The Psychopath Test. I was reading loads of that and thinking, yep, I can relate to a lot of the stuff stuff that you're saying here that makes people a psychopath. And so how...
But were you worried about that? Were you worried that you might be a psychopath?
Definitely not by the end of the book.
Right, because you're sure you weren't one.
Yeah, or more... This is going to sound really odd. More that I felt it's another thing where there's levels of it, and in certain ways and in certain manners, it's not necessarily a bad thing. Which that might make me more of a psychopath. But there were certain bits I was thinking, right, I'm actually okay with that. If that makes you slightly on the psychopath scale, as it were, then that's fine. And again, you realise that not always in a good way, but many successful people have to have a level of that, a level of disconnect from society or disconnect from even from friends and family, because they have to be so into this particular area or so driven in a particular way. So
well, sometimes I wish I was a bit more psychopathic, because it would make me feel less anxious. Anxiety is the opposite of psychopathy, and I feel too anxious too much of the time. That's something I wish wasn't in my life. If I take a Xanax, I feel very groggy. And I think I'd rather feel anxious than groggy.
That's fair.
So, but just to finish the justice thing.
Let's go. We're going to go off on a lot of tangents, I feel. But go on.
But so basically I was like trying to work out how to do something on justice. And I just couldn't. And I'm glad in a way, because this was before Serial came out. And I would have been like, my book would have come out just after Serial. And I would have been fucked. So, because Serial was so perfect. Mainly perfect. So, and then I don't know, it hit me that on social media, we thought we were going to do things better. And we were actually repeating lots of the mistakes that the actual justice system was doing. And that became really interesting to me, because I thought, this is about us. And that's, I think, you know, none of that's really in the book, but I think that is the reason why I wrote the book.
I mean, that's fascinating, because obviously, the way social media has gone has become such a bizarre thing. The latest book I've not had a chance to read yet, but from what I've read up on it, it's fascinating to highlight the fact that we've become this. Number one, it's become, well, not only has it become acceptable to publicly shame, but at often points it's become expected or felt that you have a responsibility to publicly shame and to publicly attack and bring down people, because we've now all got this voice, we're now all a media together, so we need to attack in this way, which is a bizarre and cold
it's disproportionate trait. Punishment. You know, people do stupid things and they are then, you know, disproportionately punished for it. And it shuts off, you know, there's just two, you know, there's just been two in the last couple of days. There was that guy Tim Hunt, you know, the scientist who went to South Korea and made this speech, this fucking idiotic speech, where he said, you know, the problem with women scientists is that... straight away, shut the fuck up. The problem with women scientists is that they... you fall in love with them and they fall in love with you. They're distractingly sexy. And if you criticise them, they cry. So he sort of chuckled to himself and got off the stage. And then, you know, with... fucked. And, you know, of course, clearly, it was a completely idiotic thing to say, but now he's been fired and, you know, and that's it now for his career. So, because social media demanded it. You know, obviously what he said was idiotic and reductive and doesn't help social justice and help women scientists, but was his, you know, total career destruction the only solution to it? Option. You know, not necessarily.
It is a fascinating, bizarre one. It's caused us to have far more of a killer instinct in that manner than it is now. It's like, right now, they need to be sacked. It's like, well, is this the first time he's done this? Is this a serial?
I don't think so. I mean,
without a level of being informed, we're quick to go, right, that person is evil.
Yeah.
And therefore this happens.
Exactly. I'm going to say this in this talk I'm doing tomorrow. You know, you can lead a good ethical life, but some bad phraseology in a tweet can overwhelm it all and become a clue to your secret inner evil.
Yeah.
Which isn't true about humans by and large.
Yeah.
You know, some people are so bad and their transgressions are so bad that they deserve to be overwhelmed by them.
Yeah.
You know, they deserve to be defined by them. But most people aren't that. So, and the other one that happened is, and I believe with this guy Tim Hunt, I mean, I'm not entirely sure about this, but I believe this was isolated stupidity,
right? Yeah,
and not a
not a series of
not a series.
And again, it's a weird thing. I remember when the I was listening to the Joe Rogan podcast, and it was a while after. I can't think of the guy's name, but it was a big American football kind of owner, and a mistress of his or something had leaked. Right. Recordings of him being really racist, just hideously racist. And my natural instinct is, what a piece of shit, what a horrible person, can he? But Rogan's argument was, he is that, but he said those things in his own home behind closed doors, and there's a level of, it's not really our place or business to attack that. Do you know what I mean? His privacy has been invaded. So whilst I do think he's horrible, I also think we shouldn't have the right to know about that or to attack him for that. And it was kind of, he should be suspended and kicked off, and a lot of stuff like that happened. And it was a curious thing there, how it became, what was a public issue became, or what was a private issue became a public issue. And it's weird knowing where that level is, because again, whilst I completely agree that if this was an isolated incident with this Tim Hunt guy, then is that the only solution? You'd think that if it's an isolated incident, it could be isolated publicly, but it could be something that he expresses and feels regularly privately. Yeah. But again, does that then become under our jurisdiction as complete strangers to him, and does that affect what he should be doing career-wise? It's fascinating.
And also when it's just one after the other too, you just start to think, God, you know, this is just everything's fine.
What was the other one this week?
Well, the other one this weekend is a more complicated one, which I weighed in on.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. And it was this woman called Rachel Dolezal.
Yes, yes.
So, you know, she's the head of the Spokane chapter of the NAACP.
Yeah.
And it turns out that she was faking being black. She was white.
Yeah.
So I looked at this, like, the paper, and I thought, fuck, what a weird, strange,
absolutely bizarre,
complicated,
and fascinating,
bizarre, fascinating, mysterious story. So I went on Twitter, and Twitter, by and large, wasn't thinking of it as a complicated, fascinating, mysterious, you know. Yeah. Sorry, Twitter was like rushing to judge. I mean, some people were being funny about it, and funny is good.
Yeah.
But a whole bunch of people were going, you know, blackface, racist, you know, racial appropriation, and so on. And I just thought, it seems to me that this woman's story is really complicated.
Yeah.
And to just immediately define her before we know any of the facts is not judicial.
That's been in my exact feeling on it, is I need to know a bit more before I think
there's nothing wrong with a bit of waiting.
I think
there's
no way that I'm going to be convinced she's right as such, but it's a thing of trying to figure out how wrong she is. You quite quickly, on the tiny bit of research I did, her family, the family she grew up in, they adopted a lot of people of different ethnicities. So I don't know, it's an odd thing where she may have grown up submerged in that culture, and therefore, in a way, if she hadn't pretended to be part of that culture, she would be a strong ally in that, in fighting for rights, and there wouldn't be anything wrong with that. But it's the fact that she kind of made her hair curly and got tanned that was like, and the actual interview where it was exposed was just the most bizarre and awkward thing of them just saying, are you of African origin? And she just kind of said, I don't understand the question.
Yeah.
It was like, oh, damn.
But then this person's life, I mean, this is really weird and you know, but it did strike me that this person's life then becomes everybody's plaything.
Yeah.
And that's what And it's some people's ideological plaything, and it's for other people it's just something to be funny about, and then for other people it's just something to scream at.
Yeah.
And I just felt, you know, maybe after like 30 years of dealing in this kind of world, you know, of being a journalist.
Yeah.
When I looked at all of this, in all honesty, I thought, I don't know if I've got the stomach for this anymore. It's like, we know nothing about this woman's life. We know nothing about her.
Yeah.
This is obviously like fucked up and complicated. I don't want her to be my plaything.
Mm.
I want her to have some humanity and some, I want people to be compassionate. And so I said as much on Twitter.
I bet that went down amazingly.
went down brilliantly.
Yeah.
Now you can imagine, like, you know, especially because I'm a white man.
Yeah.
So like a lot of people said, you know, things along the lines of, as a white man, you've got no right. This is not your story. I don't know. But that's where I came from. It's like, I come from a world where the least you can do is to find out about somebody.
Yeah, I think
before condemning them.
You said exactly, I write there as well, that waiting is perfectly acceptable. Uh-huh. We don't all have to go immediately, right, fuck this person. You know, jumping in too quickly when we don't know all the facts. I think the scary thing, and I've discussed this in the past with blogs, but it's become even ahead of blogs now, just because we are all the media, we are all sharing the news, is the problem there. It's exciting because it's free and it's not, it can be uncorrupted, it can be agenda free, it can be really hearing from the people, but the fact is we've not all studied journalism and learnt fact checking and source checking and everything that should be part of. And again, there's a lot of arguments of the general media has gone a long way away from that for many years now anyway, but still it's thing of...
And also, I mean, the things I'm criticising social media for, I mean, the mainstream media, you know, has been doing that stuff for years too.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, turning people into one dimensions and so on. And, you know,
and
God knows,
making billions of them in that manner.
Yeah, and I used to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, I would like to think that I haven't done it for a long time.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's what pays well in journalism, and it's wrong. You know, it's wrong. So, and I think the reason why I feel emotional about it when it happens in social media is because I really felt with social media we had the chance to do things better.
Yeah.
And I don't think we're really doing anything better.
No, we really aren't.
Yeah.
We're really just, perpetuating everything that we're meant...
Yeah.
We're making the same mistakes.
The same mistakes as the mainstream media, the same mistakes as the justice system.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're making the same mistakes. You know, we could have created a world of curiosity.
Yeah.
And instead we're creating a world of condemnation.
Yeah, completely.
So that's where I came from, and the reason why I weighed in on that woman's story.
Yeah.
But it went down badly.
Yeah.
And
I can imagine.
Yeah. So, and now I'm sort of just emerging from that.
It frightens me how easily swayed we are as people and how easily we will... believe a thing, as long as we've heard someone else say it, then that's our opinion now, and someone will attack you hugely just because they've read 2 seconds ago, they've heard about this 2 seconds ago, they've not had time to actually formulate their opinion, but they've read someone else's opinion, therefore they know that you're wrong and you're evil, rather than
and then I'm turned into a monster. I mean, somebody wrote, like, a well-known writer and blogger wrote, waiting for John Ronson to ever write a piece supporting people of colour, sex positive people.
Yeah.
I've written, like, for 30 years I've been writing those pieces.
Yeah,
you know, so basically what that's saying is it's okay to write about these wronged people, but don't write about those wronged people.
Yeah.
You know, as far as I'm, you know, because I believe in humans more than I believe in ideology, for me, a wronged person is a wronged person, whether they're a fashionable one or not.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, I've really done my time writing about people being abused by power.
Yeah.
And I feel it's okay for me to also write about people being abused by the power of social media.
Yeah. It's, I mean, that's it. It's such, isn't it? I mean, it's fascinating. It's such a bizarre thing now, as you said, that... The fact is, you're lack of bias in which wrongings you're willing to cover is something that is now is publicly shamed or judged. Yeah. Is something that you will at points probably feel conscious of that, of going, right, no, I do want to speak out about this because I feel this is how I feel, and I feel, you know, no boundary between who you should judge in that manner. Yet there's probably a pause at points of going, oh God, but if I...
Yeah, if I
as soon
that.
As I do, I'm instigating. It's yeah. a fascinating thing. It's similar. Similarly, or almost loosely, I guess, I had an argument on social media when just before the election, because a friend of mine who supports the Greens was saying there was a lot of talk that the Greens should be represented in the debates, and Cameron turned around and said they should be represented in the debates, in this particular debate. And their post was, look, I don't agree with him in general, but if the Prime Minister is saying they should be, then they should be. And I was furious at that, because I was like, right, so that's saying you feel he should have a right to choose who's in the debates. Therefore, you should support. If he says they shouldn't, you should say, well, if the Prime Minister says they shouldn't, they shouldn't. You can't only support an argument or a situation because it's in your favour. Similarly, I'm pro many of the protests and much of the uproar. I'm not a fan of the Conservatives personally, but I don't think it's fair to support a voting system up to the point that you think you're going to win, and then when you don't, say, well, it needs to change, this isn't fair. It's like, well, a week ago, if you'd won, you'd feel it was fair. So I feel you have to be either against that system in general or kind of put your hands up and go, well, you know,
yeah.
I engaged in it. I believe in it. It didn't go my way. Things not going your way isn't a reason to rally against it. Do you know what I mean? If you're engaging in it.
Yeah. I've got to say, when the Tories got in the second time, by the way, my rose-tinted sort of glasses fell off a little bit.
Yeah.
Because living in New York, whenever anything goes bad,
yeah,
I think that wouldn't happen in Britain.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we're a sort of liberal democracy. You know, we understand, we believe. And then they fucking vote them back in again.
I mean, or how do you feel then, having just written about a social media and having encountered opposition on social media, how do you feel about the trait? Because I think one of the things that, or for me, one of the mistakes a lot of people make is only existing in life and on social media within your own circles and people that support your beliefs. So everyone who was shocked saying, I don't know anyone who voted Conservative, it's like, that's because you don't know anyone who voted, you know, to sound really stupid, it's because you don't know anyone who would vote Conservative. That's why you don't know anyone who voted Conservative. If you follow, and it's tough on Twitter and social media because to follow people you don't agree with or don't like, surely it gives you a broader perspective of the actual world and situation, rather than all my friends are saying that the Conservatives aren't going to get in.
Yeah, it's like, exactly.
Well, right then, that's because that's all you're listening to is your friends.
Yeah.
That's not the only people in the country.
I agree with every word you said. In fact, I remember on...
It's hard, though. It's not an easy thing to actively...
I follow. I deliberately follow some people that I really don't like or agree with.
Yeah.
But it's hard. It's hard to follow Louise Mensch.
Yeah.
I might have to unfollow her because she just drives me insane. But you're right. One of the big problems is that, you know, Twitter's a mutual approval machine. As you said, we surround ourselves with people who feel the same way we do,
and we all pat each other on the back. And go, isn't the world?
Someone
nice
tweeted me on
great?
Yeah, on election night. Someone presciently tweeted me, if I hadn't read your book on the Twitter echo chamber, I'd be thinking now that Ed Miliband is about to become, you know, emperor of everything.
Yeah, yeah.
Other times, though, it does work. Like, I worried that, I was in Dublin just before the vote about gay marriage.
Yeah.
And I was sort of worried that the same thing would be true there. Like, because, you know, what that implies is that social media is bad for the left, because it's like it makes people apathetic. It's like we all think it's just a dead cert that Miliband's going to get in, and so people don't vote, and then he loses. You know, there is that argument. I think John O'Farrell made that argument after Miliband so surprisingly lost.
Yeah.
And I worried the same thing would happen, you know, with the marriage vote in Ireland, but it didn't. You know, it's a landslide.
It's fascinating because, again, the pressures of social media, and we will get round to other things at some point. But the pressures of social media, I felt quite uncomfortable when the correct vote came in Ireland. A few people hit me up saying, questioning the fact I'd not tweeted about it. And I struggled to get excited about something that I felt should have happened long, long ago. So I thought, I'm struggling to celebrate. I think it's great that it's happened now, but I think it's terrible that it's taken this long. So it was a tough one. But equally, I didn't want to tweet that because it's like, I don't want to take the shine off it. I do think it's a positive thing. I think people should be celebrating. I don't want to be the one going, well, come. Do you know what I mean? I didn't want to be bringing a dampener on it. But equally, I couldn't, with good conscience, go, yay, yeah. You know, the right things happened. It's like, well, it should have fucking happened long. It's mind-boggling that it's taken this long.
Yeah. Also,
in England as well, the length of time it took. It was one of them. It was like, this is great news, but it shouldn't be news. It should just be a thing that's happened and that's that, you know.
Also, you shouldn't feel you have to, like, you shouldn't feel that you have to tweet the appropriate thing when everybody else is tweeting the appropriate thing, because that's conformity.
Well, Def is the prime example. Like, when I had Simon Pegg on, he was saying the reason he left Twitter was exactly that, was the obligation to
be sad about Christopher Lee dying.
Of someone dying. Yeah, yeah. Say, well, RIP, you know, it's like, well...
Yeah. They have to constantly prove that you're an appropriate person.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that creates a conservative, conformist...
Yeah.
Society, even though we see ourselves as nonconformists.
Yeah.
I mean, I love Twitter, but I think the time's going to have to come when, you know, it's like my friend Adam Curtis, a few months ago, probably about 6 months ago, he said to me, I think the internet is going to be like one of those John Carpenter movies from the 80s where everybody's like, you know, shooting each other and screaming and people are going to flee to a safer place. And he's like, you know, maybe the internet will go the way of... You know, the fucked up inner city communities of the 80s, and, you know, people will find a better, calmer, nicer place to live. And maybe it's true. Completely. Maybe people will start fleeing the internet.
We put this podcast up on an app called Acast as well as everywhere else. On Acast, we can add links, and we're going to have a link now to everything Adam Curtis has ever done, because I think everyone listening should just get, I think he's absolutely just amazing. Approach and outlook on his documentaries, everything, just so beautifully.
He's helped me so much over the years. He was the first person ever to read my book, Them. First person to read The Men Who Stay at Goats.
Yeah.
First person to read The Psychopath. All my books, he's been the first. He was like my first reader.
Yeah.
Yeah, brilliant. And really helped. I mean, massively helped me with Them. Like, I was really struggling to work out what... Them sort of touches issues of globalization, which I kind of knew nothing about.
Yeah.
All these conspiracy theorists were convinced that this shadowy cabal called the Bilderberg Group ruled the world.
Yeah.
And I needed to then work out, well, what's the Bilderberg Group? What does that mean?
Yeah.
And I just couldn't get my head around that world economics. So Adam taught me.
One of the things I loved about Them, though, was you took the reader on that journey as well. Because when I read it... It's a special book to me because I'll tell a brief story of it. Glastonbury 2006 was the first time I got booked to play Glastonbury, and playing Glastonbury is a huge deal for anyone in music. It was amazing. I was excited to be there, but I was there with Dan Lesac, but he was there with his girlfriend, so I was kind of on my own at points, and the weather was awful. So it was one of the years that it really rained heavily, and I was staying.
I think I might have been there that year. Who was headlining? I
can't even think. So. I was so arrogantly excited about my own gig.
God, I had my worst bit of narcissism. Can I just interrupt with this? I was on a train, like when I was doing my book tour for So You've Been Publicly Shamed.
Yeah.
And I was on a train going from Manchester to Glasgow, I think it was.
Yeah.
And I looked out the window and there was an eclipse. And I'm like, oh, there's an eclipse. Like, I wonder if anyone knows. I realised then that, like, if the eclipse hadn't been mentioned in one of the reviews of my book, I would have had no idea.
Brilliant.
Yeah. Anyway, so go on.
So it was raining heavily, and on one of the days I was staying in, and I had a Toyota Space Cruiser at the time, and a guy, Will, from Lex Records, had lent me Them, and I hadn't started it yet, and I read almost all of it, just sat in the Space Cruiser while it was raining,
right.
with one of the world's most respected and loved and desired festivals going on around me, and me just sitting in my van having a read. And I said, what I loved about it was it took you on that journey of I wasn't aware of much of it, but the beauty of you not being aware of much of it meant that we all learned about it. Yeah, you know what I mean? It was, it wasn't a, here's this stuff and you should all know or you're an idiot. It was like,
I don't know why more writers don't write that way. Yeah. There's this weird sort of fetish amongst journalists to be seen to be like superior and knowing all the answers before they write the book. You know, so many nonfiction books start with this is a book about, and you know, blah, and I'm going to tell you why blah is blah is blah. But, you know, my books are the opposite. I'm like, I go into a world that I know nothing about, and, you know, and I have an adventure inside that world. Yeah. And sometimes I totally change my mind, like in the psychopath test, like midway through I realised I'd become like drunk with my psychopath spotting powers, which had turned me a little bit psychopathic. Yeah, and so I do this 180 degree turn. And that feels to me, you know, like the best way to write. Like in them, I became really paranoid. Like I thought I was being chased. Well, I thought I was being chased by the Bilderberg Group because I was actually being chased by the Bilderberg Group.
And that's what was fascinating with it. And just quickly, I do want to talk more about them, but I think you're right. I think I always feel QI is a great example of this. I think QI is far more enjoyable and watchable than a university challenge or any of these kind of things, because Alan Davis plays the idiot to allow us all to be the idiot.
Right.
He questions the stuff that we don't know to allow us all to go, oh, I'm glad. Do you know what I mean? I'm glad someone asked that question because I wasn't sure on that. Oh, I always thought that. And it's the one that we can all laugh at him and go, oh, look, he always loses. He's so silly. When in actuality, he's a very intelligent individual. But I think that allows that. And again, it's similar if you... If you show your learning and journey, it allows it seamlessly. And again, I think you've got a good way of doing it without seeming, as I said, as if you're talking down or holding our hand in a patronising way. Yeah. You're kind of going, yeah, I wasn't sure on this. So,
well, I never feel patronising. I never feel and you know, but on social media, it's like no one does that. Like no, you know, well, I mean, you know, a lot of people will hear the Rachel Dolezal story and just immediately form a certain judgment.
Yeah.
And will just scream out their certain judgment.
And without really knowing.
Without knowing. I mean, who knows? Like, you know, like within hours of, you know, the Rachel Dolezal thing happening, like everybody felt like they knew exactly what her motives were, that she was a scheming, cynical, you know, psychopathic liar.
Yeah.
She may be all those things, but when people were yelling all that stuff out at her, no one knew.
Yeah.
You know, so, and it's good to be in a world where you don't know and then you try and work it out.
And you're allowed to learn it. I tweeted the other day just to let people know, it was about a month or two ago, to let people know I just looked up the word austerity in the dictionary. Because to be honest, I didn't really have 100% certainty of what austerity was. Yet everyone's there's anti-austerity marches. Everyone I know is against, conservatives. It's like, and I was against it, but I was like, actually, I don't really know what... I know it's rich people screwing over poor people, but I don't really know what it is. So I looked it up. And again, I'm sure there'll be tons of people listening now who...
Yeah.
Just go and look it up. Have a look at... In fact, we'll put a link now to austerity in the dictionary.
You can, was it a different definition to what you thought it might be?
Slightly. It was slightly... Again, but again, I had such a broad... It was one of them things... Again, I didn't feel... Until that point, I hadn't particularly felt a need to know. I knew it was wrong. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? And again, it's the same with all these different public shaming things. Yeah. It's like, I don't really know. I just... I've had a thing for a while, and it's lazy, but I often feel... It's varied a bit because we've disagreed on a few things in the last few years, but generally, if Billy Bragg's against something... I know he's done the research, so you know, I can generally just go, right, I can generally assume that that's wrong because he knows what he's talking about. So, yeah, and again, it's that it's blindly following, I guess.
It reminds me a bit of, like, 9/11 truthers. Like, and they would get so fucking annoyed with me, and they'd be...
Yeah.
They would, suddenly everybody was a structural engineer. Like, everybody knew how buildings are supposed to fall down when planes go into them.
Yeah. That's the scary thing of the internet, though, isn't it? How you can read one article and not question it at all. So if someone has written somewhere that structurally this, that's that.
Yeah.
It's the thing. There's a website called FullFact.org, who I've had on the podcast, and they've now got their own podcast, and they're amazing because they go through as many of these articles and claims, even whether it be claims in the House of Commons or on Facebook or wherever, and Britain First posts, and they go, right, let's do the research on that and break it down. And I think that's so key because so many, it's so easy now to just share things without again, you see it written down in one place. And previously, pre-internet, generally to get it written down, if it was hokum or unresearched, it was a lot of effort to get that printed and published. Do you know what I mean? It was still happened. I'm not saying that's not a thing, but it was far more effort than just upload a blog and that's that, it's there.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true.
So let's get back to them briefly. What I liked about them was you went in, again, there was just, for such an association, you went in as a skeptic as myself, and then you found a lot of interesting realities.
Yeah, well, I started getting chased by the Bilderberg group.
How was that?
Fucking terrifying.
Yeah.
I remember afterwards I gave a talk to a skeptic society and joined the Q&A. Somebody went, so you were figuratively chased by men in dark glasses? And I was like, there's nothing figurative.
Nothing figurative.
But, yeah, I was fucking chased by men in dark glasses.
Because that was so, after you'd witnessed...
what had happened was...
Or was it on your way to witnessing?
It was on my way. So basically we discovered me and this conspiracy investigator called Big Jim Tucker, who's passed away now. But I mean, he honestly, for somebody who smoked 8 a day, he lasted a fucking long time.
He did good, fair play.
So he's dedicated his life to tracking down the Bilderberg group, who were meeting this weekend while we talk.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Nowadays, like, partly because of me, I think. Loads of people go and like protest Bilderberg meetings. And
so what are the Bilderberg group? It's generally the most powerful, the richest. There's political ties. There was always talk that they handpick the presidents and things like that and have that general control. They're the Illuminati, essentially.
Yeah, that's certainly what people believe. And you know, I think they're very good. I mean, knowing who the next president or prime minister is going to be.
Yeah.
And I said that when I finally got
to meet.
That's
interesting.
Yeah.
Because that doesn't mean you're necessarily putting them in or choosing. You just know how everything's working and know the system well enough to go, they're next, let's support and let's get...
And maybe, I mean, maybe help things along a little bit. Somebody told me about... Okay, yeah, somebody said to me, like, eventually, like, after I got chased by the Bilderberg group and they'd spied on me and they would, like, follow me back to my hotel, I eventually got to meet, like, and talk to about three members of the Bilderberg group, and one of them said to me, here's something for your conspiracy theorists. Margaret Thatcher goes to Bilderberg in about, I can't remember exactly, like, about 76, 77, so about 2 years before she was elected, and she was really shit. She was like a kind of church mouse, and that night, somebody said to her, like, maybe Henry Kissinger or somebody said to her, you know, make more of an effort, and then the next day, she stood up and gave this kind of, Thatcher special, this kind of passionate, you know, speech.
Soon to be trademark Thatcher.
Exactly. And then all like the billionaires there at Bilderberg were like really impressed by her.
Yeah.
And then when she went to America, David Rockefeller like took her around in a limousine and introduced her to everybody.
Yeah.
Because he was impressed with how she was at Bilderberg. Yeah, so the guy said, you know, is that a conspiracy? You know, in a way it is. It's networking. It's powerful networking that the likes of you and me we're never going to get driven around by David Rockefeller in a limousine.
So again, it's that weird thing of it's just that association and connections. When we had Josie Long on, and we talked about her, the arts, I can't think of what they're called now.
Arts Emergency.
Arts Emergency, they're one part of it. And their whole role is to kind of form an alternative to that within the arts, within everything else, to say, right, we will form a network so you can have these connections. So are they an evil group? They're reacting against that, but they're building the same thing, and obviously they're not. In case that wasn't clear, obviously they're not an evil group. But yeah, it's a similar thing. If it's just people connecting with mutual interests, I guess.
Yeah.
Where it's a blurred line of conspiracy theories and power.
What I love,
but
though,
were chased by many.
Yeah, and I
dark
really,
glasses.
Yeah, and I loved what Bilderberg Group did to my. To my imagination and did to my sort of paranoia and so on. That, to me, that was really interesting.
Yeah.
Because I thought it was all a jape. I thought I'd go to Portugal with Big Jim Tucker and we'd like sneak into this hotel, this five-star hotel, and sneak around and form, you know, forge contacts with waiters. And I thought it would be like silly and funny. And it was all silly and funny right up until we did all of that. This was like the day before the Bilderberg Group was supposed to arrive. And then left, and I saw in my rearview mirror that I was being followed, I was being pursued. So eventually I phoned up the British Embassy. I mean, it's, you know, a chase ensued. I mean, I say a chase, I was going 30 miles an hour, so was he.
Yeah.
But if I'd gone faster, he would have gone faster.
It would have been a hell of a chase,
If I'd gone 50, he'd have gone 50. So I can't think of any speed faster than that.
That's it. That's top.
I'm like Mrs. Armitage on wheels. I'm like a Quentin Blank drawing.
It's beautiful because, again, it makes me think instantly of the Alan Partridge scene where he's booked and... a conference room under the name of the Real IRA, and then when he gets there, he's thought it's all. And then when he gets there are police. He has to die. It feels like a similar thing where you're like, "Oh, this will be a laugh. Let's have a hunt about." And it's like, "Oh shit, they're following us now. This is real."
I was terrified. So the first thing I did was Big Jim Tucker in the back of my car is like loving it.
Yeah,
like looking out the window and waving at them. Yeah. And like I'm just, I phone up my wife. And I say I'm being followed by the Bilderberg Group. They're like, this is. I think this is all going to end. You know?
Do you think it was a level of scepticism on your part that made you more comfortable with it until it became a reality? Do you think there was a level of, oh, it's not, it's a bit silly, and then it's like,
fuck,
damn, we're actually doing this to powerful people.
Well, I phoned up the British Embassy and I said I'm being followed by the Bilderberg Group, and she went, go on. she said, what are you doing here? And I said that. I said, I am essentially a humorous journalist out of my depth.
Yeah.
Can you phone Bilderberg and tell them that?
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Fuck it. So they chased me back. They followed me back to the hotel. The funniest thing was the woman from the British Embassy phoning me back and saying the Bilderberg Group denied. They were denying following me.
Mm.
And how could they call off someone who didn't exist?
Yeah.
And I'm like, he's behind the tree. He was literally, while she was telling me that, there was a man literally looking at me from behind a tree.
I can see
him. This was back at our hotel. Yeah. And then she said, the good news is if you know you're being followed, they're probably just trying to intimidate you. And the dangerous ones would be those that you don't know are following you.
But
I thought two things at this. I thought, A, how does the press officer at the British Embassy in Portugal know that? Fuck, is this like a level of knowledge? B, one of these people are the dangerous ones, and I just happen to be naturally good at spotting them.
I was going
to
say, was there a level of, I'm an experienced journalist, I'm good at spotting stuff, I'm very aware.
And so also a very anxious person, which makes me good at spotting things.
Yeah, of course. So how did that... How did it resolve itself? Give some closure to the listeners.
Well, I went to the beach, freaked the fuck out, really wanted to go back to England. I wanted to abandon the story and go back to England.
Because there was just some bizarre ritualistic type action going on.
Well, actually, the rituals were different secret society.
That was Bohemian Grove.
I mean, there's a real crossover. Yeah, lots of the same people go to both. In general, Bilderberg is a bit more kind of centrist and Bohemian Grove is a bit more right-wing. But they're both secret clubs.
Powerful secret clubs.
And I did successfully manage to get into Bohemian Grove and witness the owl ritual. Where they all dress up in robes and throw a papier-mâché effigy into a bonfire in front of a giant stone owl.
Oh, what a thing to witness.
I witnessed that with my own eyes.
Yeah,
it was
Thank
amazing.
God you've still got the memory.
I know. That's one bit of memory that's not going to go.
Hold it in,
But with Bilderberg, so that was much later. That was probably about 2 years later. But with Bilderberg, I went to the beach.
Yes.
And got back to the hotel. And I would, in my hotel lobby, there were these two men like in dark glasses and suits. And as soon as they saw me, they picked up brochures and started reading them.
Brilliant.
Yeah. And I thought, fuck, you know, how long is this going to last? And how long did it last? It kind of went away the next day.
Again, so hilarious when it's not actually happening in your real life.
Yeah.
But in the actual, that must just be...
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah, it was a reality. Because it's so fictional, it's such a silly thing that's not real. And again, I can see how you could have got that far into it without it, because it's so silly. Yeah. It's films.
That's happened a number of times, actually. I was with this real-life superhero called Phoenix Jones.
And, right,
yeah,
brilliant.
Who was, like, fighting crime on the streets of Seattle.
Amazing.
And again, I thought, oh, this will be fun. And before I know it, we're being, like, surrounded by 30 armed... crack dealers.
Damn.
Saying, if you don't get off our block, we're going to shoot you.
Yeah.
So again, that was a time when...
Stop being quite stopped, so
not,
fun.
Not so funny, yeah.
We're at the 50-minute mark. If you're okay, I want to go on, a fair chunk longer, but I'm going to pause it here so we can split the podcast into two.
Okay.
So we'll continue in the next bit. I want to talk about the men who stare at goats. I want to talk the specific things in the psychopath test, and I also want to talk about Frank and numerous other things. So
sure.
We'll stop there and continue shortly.
You've been listening to Scrooby's Picks Discretion Pieces.
There we go. How is this for a teaser? In part two, he goes on to talk more about the superhero encounter where he was out with a real-life superhero or crime stopper, and they were surrounded by a group of armed crack dealers. If that doesn't get you downloading part two, I don't know what will. Part two will be up at midday today. If you downloaded this on Wednesday, if it's not Wednesday, it's already up. Part two's already there. It might even already be on your phone. I know some of you guys are slick, and a lot of you support us by subscribing and having automatic downloads set up. That is a great way to support us. If you don't want to buy stuff and pay for stuff, the best way to support us for free... Number one is to subscribe and auto-download. Number two is to tell your friends and spread the good word. We don't have a marketing budget. You get this for free. So, yeah, a word of mouth is absolutely key to us. So, yeah, thank you for listening. See you all shortly in part two.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.